Hi, Anthony Fennell here. Now, before we begin today's podcast, let me give you a recommendation. Why? Well, because recommendation is everything these days, of course. So here's one from me. If you like the sorts of complex issues explored on Future Tense, then you're really going to like the RN podcast, All in the Mind. It's produced by RN Science Unit, and it's an exploration of the brain and behaviour. All in the Mind. You can get it from the RN website, the ABC Radio app, or from iTunes.
Did you use that $916 million loss to avoid paying personal federal income taxes?
Of course I do. Of course I do. And so do all of her donors, or most of her donors. I know many of her donors. Her donors took massive tax write-offs.
So a lot of my,
a lot of my write-off was depreciation and other things that Hillary as a senator allowed. And she'll always allow it. Because
yet another reminder, this time from the most recent presidential debate in the United States, that growing wealth inequality is a major problem. How odd then that the man leading the charge against the money-grabbing elites also happens to be a proud tax-dodging multi-billionaire. Strange days indeed. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. In the latest quarterly essay, author and social commentator Don Watson paints a clear and disturbing picture of how the wealth divide currently looks in the United States.
Imagine a first world country founded on egalitarian principles in which the top 20% of households have 84% of the wealth, while the bottom 40% have 0.3%, and one family, the Waltons, own more than the bottom 40% of US families combined. And the ratio of CEO salary to unskilled worker is 354 to 1. 50 years ago, it was 20 to 1.
Now, as an advanced Western nation, the US might be at the extreme in its contrast between the have and the have-nots, but inequality right across the developed world has been on the rise. And it's important to realise that, because that trend underpins the proposal we want to look at today. The idea for a universal basic income.
Essentially, the notion is that welfare recipients will essentially receive a basic, sort of standard uniform basic income from the government. The basic income is different to that of sort of existing sort of welfare payments that exist in most countries, in that the criteria doesn't depend on how old you are, your working hours, disability status, or what have you.
That's Michaela Novak, a senior fellow with the Institute of Public Affairs.
Small-scale trials have been investigated actively in Finland. There was a recent referendum in Switzerland. And in the past, indeed, there have been small-scale trials of similar kinds of programs in Canada, Alaska, and elsewhere. So it is an interesting welfare reform being investigated actively.
So regardless of your circumstances, every child wins a prize, so to speak. And it's the universal nature of such a payment, according to proponents, that would then ensure against absolute poverty for those on the lower socioeconomic rungs of society, or so the theory goes. It's certainly not a cure for wealth inequality by any stretch. It wouldn't stop the super rich from continuing to grow their money, but it would act as a form of safety net. Now, here's the odd thing. In a world of black and white politics, of polarisation, the notion of a universal basic income has its supporters on both sides of the political fence. Eduardo Porter writes for the New York Times on matters economic.
There are many, many variants of this. In some instances, it's represented as only giving adults money. In others, it's giving adults, children, and everybody money. But the purpose of this is also a little bit all over the map. It depends on who is actually putting the idea forth. If you hear it from the technologists on the west coast of the United States, it's proposed as a solution to a future where there will be no jobs. There will be very few jobs for people to do, and you will need some alternative mechanism to sort of like distribute money around the economy. There are people on the left, a former labor leader, Andy Stern, in the United States, wrote a book supporting the idea, and on the the right, you have Charles Murray of the American Enterprise Institute, who also wrote a book supporting the idea, but it's not universally popular. I think what it holds for the right is this promise of getting the government out of people's lives, kind of like a bit of the libertarian goal. So rather than giving them housing vouchers, which would sort of determine where people live, or giving them food stamps, which somehow determines on what they can use the money, you just give the money and people decide what to do with it on their own. So that is kind of appealing to the right, within reason. I mean, you have, again, different strands of thinking there. And on the left, there is this idea that if the labor market is broken in a substantial way, and by this, I mean the labor market hasn't given people a raise in 3 decades, then maybe there is a role for the government to provide more to working families. And so that's what makes it popular on the left.
And one of those on the left who's recently championed the idea of a universal basic income is Britain's Shadow Chancellor, or Treasurer, John McDonnell. Only a few weeks ago, in an interview with The Independent, Mr. McDonnell flagged the idea that Labour might take a UBI to the next UK general election. It was a proposal, he said, that had the potential to simplify the welfare system and deal with poverty and inequality. But he also indicated he'd be watching the way in which trials play out in Finland and elsewhere before making a decision. Rutger Bregman is a Dutch writer and UBI advocate. He's also the author of a new book on the subject called Utopia for Realists.
Well, I think the main argument is actually very simple. For me, it is all about freedom. So we have all kinds of freedom in the West, of course, like freedom of religion, freedom of speech. But what we don't have is the real freedom to decide for yourself what you want to make of your lives. Many people simply don't have the means to do so. So what we see is that many people in Western countries are stuck in so-called bullshit jobs. This is the kind of jobs that even the people who have them themselves consider absolutely meaningless and pointless. And there are actually quite a lot of those jobs, about 37% in England, for example. So for me, the basic income is mostly about freedom to decide for yourselves what you consider really interesting and useful. So it's all about redefining and rethinking what work actually is. Nowadays, when we think about work, we think about working in a hierarchical relationship with an employer that pays us a salary, etc., etc. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of useful volunteers work and caring for our children and caring for our elderly. That's also very important, but that doesn't add to our GDP. And we need a lot more of that. And maybe we need a little bit less of, you know, corporate lawyers and PR work, etc., etc. The second main argument in favor of a basic income is that it would be the most efficient and most direct and most, I think, civilized way to eradicate poverty. You know, by definition, it eradicates poverty because it puts everyone just above the poverty line. And I personally see this as an investment. You know, poverty is extremely expensive. There are so many costs involved. Think of healthcare costs, think of higher crime rates and lower education. There have been quite a lot of experiments that, for example, when we invest in the homeless, when we invest in eradicating child poverty, you know, these are all investments that really pay for themselves multiple times, actually.
There are often assumptions made about the poor, that the poor are poor simply because they can't manage their lives or their income, their money. Does that kind of prejudice, does that sometimes play a part in the way in which the idea of a universal basic income is assessed by people?
That's a huge obstacle, you know. I've given a lot of lectures about the subject, and always when you ask people, what would you do with a basic income? And about 99% say, I've got dreams, I've got ambitions, I'm going to do something useful with it. But when you ask what will other people do, then many people think, well, yeah, other people, especially the poor, they'll probably be lazy, they'll probably spend it on drugs and alcohol and those kind of things. But, you know, we're lucky. There's a lot of research that has been conducted in this area, a lot of economic research, a lot of psychological research. And we know now from all these studies that poverty is not a lack of character, it's just a lack of money. So when you give people the means to decide for themselves what they want to do with their lives, most people will do something interesting and useful.
One concern that I have seen expressed by people, including supporters of a universal basic income, is the idea that it might actually end up inadvertently lowering wages, or it might be used as an excuse to lower wages. Your response to that?
Well, I think you have to remember that there are many, many versions of the basic income idea. Just as there are many versions of the welfare state, there are many versions of how we can implement and how we can fund a basic income. And indeed, if you get rid of the welfare state as we have it now and only give a small basic income back in return, many people will be worse off. There's no doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that there are versions of the idea that will be good for a lot of people. And what's also very important to remember, I think, is that if you give people who now have low incomes, think of garbage men, for example, or teachers or care workers or people like that, if they receive a basic income, they'll probably receive higher wages as well, because now they can say, you know, I have this basic income to fall back on. I'd like to be a garbage man, but not for this kind of wage. So you have to give me a higher wage. So I think that would be a very important effect if you'd implement a basic income nationwide.
Rutger Bregman speaking to us there from the Netherlands. Back now to Michaela Novak from the free market think tank, the Institute for Public Affairs. As we mentioned earlier, several luminaries on the political right have in the past been attracted to the idea of a UBI, people like Friedrich Hayek, for instance. And certainly, some of the things Rutger had to say there about simplifying the welfare system and letting people take charge of their own affairs definitely holds appeal for a libertarian like Michaela. But
I acknowledge the benefits of universal basic income, especially those that have been discussed by the likes of Hayek and Friedman, McCloskey and others. However, I think I would basically have two main worries about the basic income and just how feasible it might be practically. Political vote buying might lead us to a situation where a universal basic income welfare reform is basically in the long run stymied by the reintroduction of discriminatory selective elements into the welfare system. The other objection I would have as well is that universal basic income, and certainly in the current context of overstretched governmental budgets, isn't affordable. If you set a universal basic income, for example, at a single childless New Start allowance rate or at an even higher age pension rate, essentially you're asking taxpayers to pay more to introduce a universal basic income. The consequence of that is essentially bigger government, tax hikes, and more extensive fiscal churn. So I'm very open to the idea, and I think the discussion that we might have in the coming years is going to be very, very interesting indeed. But I think from my perspective, those two issues need to be sort of cleared away.
And that issue of potential cost, according to Eduardo Porter, also counts against any future plans for a universal basic income in the American context.
Yeah, it would be enormously expensive. I mean, giving $10,000 to each person would cost $3 trillion, which is about 16% of the gross domestic product of the country, and which, you know, would take a taxation in the United States of Norwegian proportions, something that Americans have never supported. So I see that as an immense obstacle. Now, people will argue against that of course we can tax this all away so that the rich won't be getting the money anyway. We will tax it back and that's how we will fund this. But it seems to me perhaps not the best idea to give people a lump sum and then tax it back to get it back from them. Why not just not give it to them in the first place? So this idea that we need an enormous sum of money is in large part because we are giving a lot of money to people who don't need it.
And Eduardo Porter also questions the ability of a UBI to affect social and economic change.
There's lots of things that a check doesn't do that are important to people. I mean, a monthly check does nothing to improve your income mobility. It does nothing to improve your well-being through life. And if your situation were to worsen due to some emergency or some shock to the labor market or whatever, a universal basic income would not adjust to that. So it basically, as insurance, it's a pretty poor device because it does not adapt to changes in the insured circumstance and provides no vehicle for improvement in that circumstance. So in that regard, it is a very blunt tool. And another way of looking at this is that some of the instruments that we have now, say housing vouchers, also serve in a kind of paternalistic way that is quite beneficial. So if we find that neighborhoods are very important for outcomes for children. Children living in neighborhoods with less crime tend to have, you know, better health outcomes and better employment outcomes and better educational outcomes. Well, a policy that helped them move to better neighborhoods is not necessarily a bad thing. A universal basic income does nothing of the sort, whereas a housing voucher system might. So there's all these other levers that one would do away with in replacing the tools that we have with something like a universal income. Not like just only changes in circumstances, but also policy objectives that are, you know, legitimate. So food stamps is not just money, it's money that can be used on a specific set of things that have been found to improve the well-being of families. So there's some paternalism in that decision, but it's, in my view, a pretty reasonable call.
You're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and today we're looking at the ins and outs of a universal basic income. The idea that everyone within a society should be given a base salary from the government in order to streamline welfare, increase opportunity, and safeguard against poverty.
Most of the evidence from the few trials that have happened suggests that even a reasonably generous basic income is not going to be so much money that people are kind of living high on the hog.
Ben Spies-Butcher is a lecturer in economics and society at Macquarie University in Sydney.
There are still going to be very strong incentives for people to go out and get work. People work for a whole range of reasons, and people are likely to want a higher living standard than the one just provided by the basic income. So actually, those tests, those experiments suggest it's not going to stop people going to work in those ways. The two groups that are most likely to leave or reduce their involvement in the labour market are young people who choose to continue on with education for longer, and are new parents who take more time to care for their children. And I think we'd probably say that both of those things are good things, that we want to encourage and give people choices which allow them to balance what's going on in their lives.
The universal nature of the proposal is one of the things that's appealing about it, but it's also problematic for some people, isn't it? The idea that people will be getting this who actually don't need it. Is there any way to deal with that sort of regressive nature of the proposal?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing that makes it most expensive. And traditionally in Australia, we've had an approach to social payments which deals with that by doing something we might call affluence testing. If you look at a payment like the age pension, where about 40% of people over 65 get the full age pension and another roughly 40% get a part pension, you say most people are receiving the payment. But because there's a means test, it does limit the cost of the pension. And it does mean that people on quite high incomes aren't receiving a payment. So that's one way that potentially solves that problem. It creates another problem, and that is that you have to have a transition arrangement where when you're earning more income, you start to lose the payment while you're also paying tax. And that can have a very strong work disincentive effect. And so if you look over the ditch to New Zealand, where the age pension is universal, it doesn't have a means test, you have higher rates of older people in the labour market, even though the payment's more generous. And that's because, or partly because, it's easier to get a little bit of work and you don't lose your pension at the same time as you're paying tax.
And for a country like Australia, do you see this as a serious proposal? I mean, it's an interesting research exercise or thought exercise, but do you see a country like Australia ever going fully down the UBI path?
Look, I think moving all the way to a basic income where we replace all of the social payments and there is a genuinely universal payment that's genuinely adequate, I think that's a fair way off. But I think we might see elements of these kinds of schemes being implemented. And what they're traditionally associated with in the countries that have the things which are closest to them is resource rent taxes. So countries that have large oil reserves, taxing those oil reserves, this happens in Alaska, for example, it's starting to happen in Iran as well. And then paying back some of that tax revenue to all of their citizens in equal proportions as a kind of dividend of citizenship. It's possible. We had a debate about a mining tax in Australia. It's possible that you might have something like that. I think it's possible that you might see changes to the age pension that expand its access. We've been moving in the opposite direction recently, increasing the age when you're eligible for the age pension. But you could imagine that in a world where people are working for longer, it might actually be useful to create a payment that helps them manage changes of career, retraining, periods where they have a little bit of work, periods where they don't have much work. And a universal payment is actually a very effective way of being able to support people, ensure that they're not going to experience poverty, but also allow them to be able to take up new opportunities and stay engaged with the labour market.
You know, classic liberals and libertarians, the appeal for them of a universal basic income is this idea of it wiping away the welfare state, what they would see as the bureaucracy of the welfare state, and replacing it with one simple measure that fits all. Various people we've spoken to for this program have talked about the possibility, though, that if you installed a universal basic income, politics being politics, over time, politicians want to go and add extra benefits onto it in order to win votes over time. So you'd have this kind of creep back, if you like. Your thoughts on that, on whether that's possible?
Obviously, that's possible. And we've seen that with, you know, take pension or you take family benefits and, you know, back to school allowances and utilities, supplements and so forth are ways you can see that happening. I also think there's another political dynamic that's likely to happen if you had a genuinely universal payment. So the pension, which is the most universal of the payments we have, is the one payment where both sides of politics over the last decade or so have made decisions to discretionarily increase that payment. It's moved in the exact opposite direction to virtually every other payment in our system where the rates have been frozen, we've actually had cuts, we've had changes to eligibility to make it much more difficult to access the payment. With the age pension, because so many more people receive it, there's strong political pressure to make sure it's adequate and to make sure it's easy to access. And I think you'd probably see the same political pressure if there was a genuinely universal basic income that united the political interests of a lot of citizens and made it very, very difficult for politicians to seriously attack it.
Ben Spies-Butcher from Macquarie University. On the show so far, we've really been talking about the notion of a UBI as a national scheme, but could it be applied effectively to a smaller subset? John Altman has been a proponent of the basic income idea since the 1970s. He's a research professor at the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation at Deakin University in Melbourne, and he's calling for a UBI for remote Indigenous Australia. It's needed, he says, because of the chronic unemployment in remote communities, which sees 4 in 5 people either unemployed or on some form of income assistance. And he's confident it will work because, he says, there is a precedent.
In 1977, a scheme was piloted called the Community Development Employment Program, or sometimes referred to as the Community Development Employment Project Scheme, that provided communities with the equivalent of people's unemployment benefit and some additional support, and basically allowed people the option of working part-time for award rates in community enterprise or social enterprise, or to work individually in self-provisioning or producing art for the market. And so what you had in a way was people having a basic income that was more or less equivalent to their welfare, but on top of that, they could earn additional income, or they could earn, if you like, what we sometimes refer to as imputed income, in other words, in-kind income, for example, through self-provisioning.
So a form of universal basic income has actually been trialled in Australia via the CDEP scheme over several decades. It ended only quite recently, but it was trialled over several decades.
It was trialled here, and this scheme, you know, had several manifestations, if you like. It could operate as a employment program. It could operate as a social or commercial enterprise development program. But where people lived in the most remote places, where there were no mainstream jobs, it operated as universal basic income. And what the scheme did is basically give people income without activity testing, in other words, without requiring them to turn up regularly to look for jobs that didn't exist. And it also allowed them to earn additional income without the operations of what's called the welfare taper, or a poverty trap, which sees, you know, people who are on welfare, when they earn extra money, they lose some of their welfare. Well, that trade-off wasn't applied with this Community Development Employment Program, and the outcomes were extremely positive. People in some situations earned extra income. So when we undertook surveys through the census or the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Survey, we found that on average, people earned $100 extra per week than people on welfare. And what's more, some people on the scheme were able to participate in extra hours of paid work at award rates. Alternatively, they're able to earn extra income from activities like arts production, or else they're able to self-provision. And importantly, I think, for Indigenous people in remote areas, they're also able to make a choice to participate in cultural activities and not be penalised, if you like, for pursuing their prerogatives.
So this form of universal basic income existed. It obviously didn't solve the problem of unemployment in remote Indigenous areas, but you do think it made a significant difference. Why was it taken away? Why was it stopped?
Well, the reason it was stopped, I think, is that there were certain advocates in Australian society, including Aboriginal activists like Noel Pearson and Marcia Langton, who were saying basically that the scheme stopped people getting proper jobs and having career pathways. And I basically don't agree with that proposition, because some people who wanted full-time work when it was available were able to transition from CDP to proper work, for example, working as waged community rangers on a full-time basis. But the scheme sort of got caught up in this whole issue of closing the employment gap. And there was a perception that people on CDP were unemployed, whereas in fact, they were defined as employed. And when they worked under the scheme, even though they worked part-time, they were paid award wages. So in a sense, you know, the scheme, I think, was unfairly portrayed as being welfare and the participants as being unemployed, whereas in fact it was a government program, people were paid award rates and they were employed and they viewed themselves as employed even if they were just getting universal basic income.
So the CDEP program was taken away. You're arguing that it should now be reinstated. What did we learn, though, from the first experiment? How would your idea of a universal basic income, if it was set up in Indigenous communities, remote Indigenous communities, how would it be different? How would it be improved on the previous model?
Well, I think what we've got to understand is what has replaced CDEP, and that is a new labour market program. But basically, at its height, CDP had about 35,000 Indigenous participants Australia-wide. Today, this new program has 37,000 participants, but these people are all classified as unemployed, and all they do is earn their welfare income. And if they don't turn up for work, they get breached. In other words, they lose their income. So in other words, they're impoverished. Now, I think that a new scheme, let's call it UBI, should be trialled on a experimental basis. We're always trying experiments, and we could do a comparative experiment by providing a community or communities or individuals within communities the equivalent of their welfare entitlement, some funding for capital and infrastructure support for community organisations, and see basically how people make a livelihood and whether things improve for them compared to people who are participating in this alternate scheme that's looking to move them into real employment that, again, I have to emphasise, often doesn't exist. And my argument is that such an experiment will demonstrate that universal basic income is better than welfare, and the cost of the scheme can be largely offset because we have these Centrelink regulatory regimes which are extraordinarily expensive. So we waste dollars regulating people on welfare and breaching them if they don't turn up for pretend work or for training for work that doesn't exist. And instead what we could do is turn that regulatory funding into much more productive use by supporting enterprise and supporting individuals who want to get involved in productive activity.
Professor John Altman from the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation. And that's Future Tense for another week. The producer for this program was Karin Savanovitz, the sound engineer, Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.